My name is Nikki Strong, and this is VOA One, the Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Andrew Smith tells us about a young girl whose doctors treated her possibly deadly genetic disorder before she was even born. Later, Dan Novak presents this week's Education Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Andrew Smith.
Ayla Bashir, a 16-month-old girl from Ottawa, Canada, is healthy after doctors used a new method to treat her before she was born. She has a rare genetic disease that killed two of her sisters. The disease, called Pompe, causes the body to fail to make some or all of an important enzyme. But a new case study describes the new treatment method that seems to be working for Ayla. The young girl's parents recently told the Associated Press their daughter is now an active, happy girl who is growing normally. The couple previously lost two daughters, Zara, 2.5, and Sarah, 8 months, to the condition. A third pregnancy was ended because of the disease or disorder. The future for Ayla is hopeful but uncertain. Dr. Karen Fung Ki Fung is a medicine specialist who works with fetuses at the Ottawa Hospital. She gave Ayla her treatments. The new method was developed by Dr. Tippi McKenzie, co-director of the Center for Maternal Fetal Precision Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. McKenzie shared her research with Fung Ki Fung. "We were all motivated to make this happen for this family," McKenzie said. In this case, doctors delivered important enzymes to the mother through her stomach. The enzymes were then guided into the umbilical cord. Ayla received 6 treatments every 2 weeks, starting at about 24 weeks of fetal development. Dr. Pranesh Chakraborty has cared for Ayla's family for years. He told the AP that what made the treatment highly effective was completing it early, while the fetus was still developing. Pompe affects fewer than 1 in 100,000 newborns. It is caused by changes in a gene that makes an enzyme that breaks down glycogen, or stored sugar, in cells. When that enzyme is reduced or removed, glycogen builds up dangerously throughout the body. In addition, the most severely affected babies, including Ayla, have an immune condition in which their bodies block the treatment enzymes. This eventually stops the treatment from working. The hope is that Ayla's early treatment will reduce that immune response. Babies with Pompe disease have trouble feeding and experience muscle weakness. They often have very enlarged hearts. When left untreated, most babies die from heart or breathing problems during the first year of life. In addition to the girls who died, Isla's parents have a 13-year-old son and a 5-year-old daughter. Neither of those children were affected by the disorder. For now, doctors are waiting to see whether the treatment can become a generally accepted form of treatment. Dr. Christina Lamb is a biochemical genetics specialist at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital in Seattle. She said it will take some time to clearly demonstrate whether the results of the new treatment are better for patients. Isla receives drugs for her immune system and weekly enzyme treatments that take 5 to 6 hours. Unless a new method is found, Isla is likely to continue the treatments throughout her life. Her parents say that every step of progress, such as when she started to crawl, has been very special. "It amazes us every time," said her mother, Sobia Qureshi. "We're so blessed. We've been very, very blessed." I'm Andrew Smith.
Next up is this week's Education Report with Dan Novak.
Growing numbers of schools in the United States are limiting how much students can use their mobile phones. Educators say phones are distracting and keep children from learning. But some parents disagree and are pushing back against the policy. Bans on the devices were increasing before the COVID-19 pandemic. Since schools reopened, struggles with student behavior and mental health have given some schools even more reason to restrict use. During the time of online learning, parents had constant access to their children. Some have not wanted to give that access up. Others say they fear losing contact with their children if there were a school shooting. With more debate on how subjects like race are taught in schools, some parents also view phone restrictions as a way of keeping them out of their kids' education. Shannon Moser has students in 8th and 9th grades in Rochester, New York. She said she felt parents were being pushed away when the local school system locked away student phones. She noted that many parents on either side of the political divide feel the same way. "Everything is just so politicized, so divisive. And I think parents just have a general fear of what's happening with their kids during the day," Moser told the Associated Press. "There is a form of accountability," she said, "when students are able to record what goes on around them." The National Center for Education Statistics found that about 65% of public schools banned mobile phones in 2015. By the 2019-2020 school year, restrictions were in place at 76% of schools. And the states of California and Tennessee recently passed laws permitting schools to ban phones. Now, educators see a need to keep students from being distracted. During the pandemic, many students experienced learning loss. Liz Karen Kolb is a professor of education technologies at the University of Michigan. She said school officials may feel like they could restrict mobile devices due to parents' concern about high amounts of screen time during the pandemic. but she said there is a wide range of parental opinions on the subject. You still have the parents that want to have that direct line of communication, she said. But I do think that there's more of an empathy and an understanding toward their child being able to put away their devices so they can really focus on the learning in the classroom. In western Pennsylvania, the Washington School District started a ban on mobile phones this year as educators found them to be a distraction. Students were on their phones in the hallways and at lunch tables. Some would call home or answer calls in the middle of a class, high school teacher Treg Campbell said. School system leader George LeMay said the ban was the right choice. He said the ban was to keep students focused on school, not try to limit their contact with families. In some cases, pushback from parents has led to changes in policy. At the Brush School District in Colorado, mobile phones were banned after teachers had concerns over online bullying. When parents pushed back, the school system held a community meeting, with most arguing against the ban. Parents said they wanted their children to have access to their phones. The policy was changed to permit phones on school grounds, but they must be turned off and put away. The school also said it would let some students use their phones for special reasons. There's not an intention to say cell phones are evil, Wilson said. Instead, it is how do we manage this in a way that makes sense for everybody? Kolb said there is no perfect answer for phones in schools. It really comes down to making sure that we're educating students and parents about healthy habits with their digital devices, she said. I'm Dan Novak.
I'm pleased to welcome Dan back to the program. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Ashley.
I was hoping you could talk about a word that comes up a lot in this story and many other stories, access.
Access can be used in a lot of different ways in English. Simply put, to have access to something is to be able to use or get something. So, public schools can have access to funds through the government. I have access to a car because I own one. And buildings have wheelchair access, meaning people with certain disabilities can enter the building easily.
You're right. It has a lot of different meanings. But how is access used in this story?
In the story, parents want access to their children through mobile phones. In other words, parents want to be able to stay in contact or communicate with their kids throughout the school day. If kids can access their phones, parents can access their kids. Does that make sense?
It does. Thanks for explaining access to us, Dan.
You're welcome. Thanks, Ashley.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. Last week on our program, we talked about the presidency of John Tyler. The future of Texas was a major issue in American politics in the early 1840s. Texas had declared its independence from Mexico in 1836. Now some Americans wanted the new Republic of Texas to become a U.S. state. But others wanted Texas to remain independent. The Republic of Texas permitted slavery. Americans who opposed Texas statehood wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler wanted to make Texas a state. Tyler was a Southerner. He supported slavery and wanted Texas to keep the system legal. The president also had political reasons for wanting Texas to join the Union. He wanted to show that he increased the size and power of the United States during his presidency. He hoped Texas statehood would win him a nomination for a second term as president. So Tyler asked his new Secretary of State, John C. Calhoun, to negotiate the annexation of Texas. On April 12, 1844, Calhoun and Texas officials agreed the territory would enter the Union. They said the new state of Texas could continue slavery. But Britain objected. A British official sent a note saying that Britain wished to end slavery wherever it existed, including Texas. Secretary Calhoun's reply to Britain went public. He defended slavery in the American South. He said what was called slavery was really a political institution necessary for the peace, safety, and economic strength of those states where it existed. Ending slavery in Texas, he said, would be a danger to the American South and to the Union itself. Many people in northern states rejected Calhoun's reasoning. They called on their senators to vote against accepting Texas. But President Tyler continued with his effort to take control of Texas. He sent Calhoun's agreement with Texas to the U.S. Senate for approval. Soon after, the Whig Party opened its national convention to nominate a candidate for president. As expected, the Whigs did not choose President Tyler. They nominated Senator Henry Clay instead. Clay had been working hard to win the nomination. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention a month later. Many Democrats wanted former President Martin Van Buren to be their candidate. But the convention took a surprising turn. The Democrats approved a rule that a candidate must receive at least two-thirds of the votes to win. In the first vote, Van Buren won the most support, but not two-thirds. The convention delegates voted again, and again Van Buren fell short. The delegates kept voting, but Van Buren never earned the number of votes he needed. In fact, Van Buren began to lose votes. Other candidates were suggested, but none of them seemed able to win the necessary two-thirds either. Finally, someone proposed a new name, James Knox Polk.
James Polk was a very fascinating man, very hardworking, relentless in his pursuit of goals. He was not a particularly likable human being. He was somewhat suspicious of other people, but he had a way of figuring out what he needed to do to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, and he was very good at it, and that served him very well throughout his life.
Historian Robert Mary wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Mary says Polk did not come to the 1844 convention expecting to be nominated for president. At the time, Polk's political career was struggling. He had already served as the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and the Governor of Tennessee. He was well-respected and serious. But Polk had lost in his attempts to seek re-election as governor not once, but twice. Polk came to the Democrats' convention hoping to re-enter national politics and perhaps win the nomination for vice president. When the convention delegates voted on their presidential candidate for the eighth time, Polk received only 44 votes. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. Historian Robert Mary says James K. Polk became the first real political dark horse in American history. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win. One reason he did was Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading Democratic candidate, Martin Van Buren, did not think so. Neither did the Whig candidate, Henry Clay. Van Buren and Clay believed that annexation of Texas could lead to a war with Mexico, and they were afraid that if Texas were to become a state, Americans would clash again over the issue of slavery. So, Robert Mary says, both Martin Van Buren and Henry Clay spoke against bringing Texas into the Union.
And that was probably the right position from a standpoint of prudence, political prudence, or maybe diplomatic prudence. But it was the wrong position from the standpoint of where the American people were politically at that time.
In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west all the way to the Pacific Ocean and dominate the continent.
It's a very powerful concept, and it was not just a powerful concept, but it was a powerful impulse of America at that time.
As a result, Robert Mary says, many voters supported James K. Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Polk told voters he did not believe the federal government should have too much power. He said presidents and other elected officials might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But historian Robert Mary says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. After all, two presidents Polk admired, Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, had each served two terms. The nation's first president, George Washington, had also served two terms. Robert Mary says Polk's one-term promise was also a political bet. Polk wanted other Democratic politicians to support him. Polk thought that if he said he would be president for only one term, other politicians might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years instead of waiting eight.
And I suspect that he was probably right. And given the closeness of the election, I suspect that had he not made that one-term promise, he very likely would have been beaten by Clay.
As it was, the election of 1844 was extremely close. Wild campaign charges were made against both candidates. The Whig candidate, Henry Clay, was called a gambler, a duelist, a man of dishonest deals. Stories were told about his use of strong language and love of card games. On the other side, Whig newspapers reported that someone saw a group of slaves being sold in Tennessee. Burned into the skin of each slave, the papers said, were the letters J.K.P., the initials of James K. Polk. In the autumn of 1844, 2,700,000 Americans elected a new president. Polk defeated Clay by only about 38,000 votes nationwide. But Polk won 170 electoral votes to Clay's 105. President Tyler believed Polk's victory showed the American people wanted Texas to become a state. When Congress met in December, he proposed that both the House of Representatives and the Senate resolve to give Texas statehood. In a few months, they did. President Tyler signed the resolution on March 1, 1845, just 3 days before he left office. The resolution invited Texas to join the Union as a state. It gave Texas the right to split into as many as four more states when its population was large enough. Texas could keep its public lands, but it had to pay its own debts. And Texas could enter the Union as a slave state. The Mexican minister to the U.S. objected to the resolution. Mexico did not recognize Texas as an independent territory. The minister said making Texas an American state was an act of aggression against his country. He demanded his passport and returned to Mexico. Britain and France also sought to prevent Texas from becoming a state. They persuaded Mexico to agree to recognize Texas independence, but only if Texas would not join the United States. Texas thus had two choices. It could join the United States, or it could continue as a republic with its independence recognized by Mexico. The Texas Congress chose statehood. But the choice would come with a cost. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.